This is Chapter a Day. I'm Susan Sweeney. Our novel is Taya Obritz, The Tiger's Wife. The novel takes place in an unnamed Balkan country, recovering from an ugly war, which has fractured the country along ethnic and religious lines. Natalia, a young doctor, has traveled on a medical mission from the city to the countryside orphanage by the sea. In this spot, there is a group of clearly diseased people, including children, who have been digging day and night in a vineyard adjacent to where Natalia and her doctor friend Zora are staying. She discovers that they are looking for the body of a cousin who was killed in the war many years ago and hastily buried far from home. A mystic has told these people that they must find the body and perform the necessary religious rites if they are to regain their well-being. Natalia has just returned to the orphanage after a quick and clandestine trip to nearby Zdrevkov, attempting to learn the circumstances of her beloved grandfather's recent death in this backwater village, far away from home and family. Her grandmother, back in the city, has been frantic that the body was returned without his personal effects. The novel moves back and forth between past and present. Near the end of this chapter, we'll be jumping back in time to the childhood of Natalia's grandfather. The Tiger's Wife, Chapter 12. On the way back from Zdrevkov, I stopped at Kolatz for the children's candy, intercepted the cashier of the gas station convenience store just as she was closing up for the evening. I had no bills left, and I grappled with her for 20 minutes, finally persuading her by paying double the amount in our currency to cover the cost of her having to go to the money exchange in the morning. She helped me load 2 boxes of local chocolate into the car, and then drove away in a little run-down hatchback that roared out a line of smoke as she pulled onto the road. There was a payphone by the deserted gas pump, and I used my last 4 coins to call my grandma. The blue bag was in my backpack, folded in half. The mortuary cold of it had stunned me, and I hadn't touched it since Drevkov. My grandma had been making funeral arrangements all day, and when she asked me if I was ready to come home, I told her about Drevkov, about going to the veterans' clinic, about how hospitable and consoling they had been. She listened to me in silence, and I realized the news of this journey was as incomprehensible for her as the idea of my grandfather's death had been to me, all of it just words on a bad line. The fact that Zdrevkov had been within driving distance seemed to comfort her, reaffirm in some way that he had been coming to see me after all. She could forgive a misunderstanding, but not an outright lie. Driving off the peninsula, I had been thinking about how my grandfather could have heard about the boys who had stepped on the landmine. The veterans' village, stragglers clinging to life after the dead had gone away. I didn't mention any of this to her. "Were they disappointed?" she said. "Were they hoping no one would come by to collect his things?" She'd been envisioning a despicable scenario in which I walked into the hospital to find my grandfather's belongings had been distributed among the staff, his hat on the head of an assistant janitor, his watch on the receptionist's wrist. "They're very busy there," I said. "They apologized for the mix-up." I didn't have the heart to tell her what kind of a place it was, that we'd been lucky to have them find us at all. Lucky he hadn't ended up on that sea-facing slope behind the clinic. "Would you like me to tell you what's in the bag?" There was a long silence. The phone clicked. My grandma finally said, "You opened it?" "Not yet." "And don't," she told me. "Don't you dare! How can you even think it?" She started in about the 40 days again, about unwittingly interrupting the progress of the soul, how the bag was a blessing, an untouched blessing, and what the hell was I thinking? She was shouting by the time she said, "What else do I have left to pay my respects with, Natalia? When I didn't know he was sick, and you didn't say anything when you knew?" The phone beeped twice, and then the line went dead. My pager rang almost immediately, and it continued to ring while I drove back to Brejovina, But I had no money left, and the afternoon was fading into evening. She gave up eventually, my grandma, and I drove with all four windows down, the draft keeping me awake. By the time I got back to the monastery, the gate was closed. I could see the low sun mirrored in the clerestory windows from the road, but the garden was empty. All along the boardwalk, the shops were dark and shuttered. The postcard stands and trays of snorkeling gear crammed behind iron screens. Some 100 years later, I came to the corner canal, and here Breivina's townspeople and tourists were standing in animated, sunburned throngs, smoking, leaning against cars, making their way slowly between the eucalyptus trees to the vineyard fence. I rolled the car into the ditch and left it there, went up the slope with my backpack in my arms, the bag still inside. There was a hot stillness over the sea, and it had crawled onto the land and stilled everything, even the vineyard. From the gate, I could see the diggers, deeper among the vines than they had been that morning. Duret was there with his pot-handle ears, standing like a scarecrow, back bent, hips thrown out. The heavyset man from that morning was there too, drinking a can of cola, his neck reddened by the sun. The boys from that morning were sitting against a dirt-field wheelbarrow among the vines. There was no sign of the young woman or the little girl. Fra Antun saw me from the vineyard gate, opened it without a word. I apologized, told him about the traffic and the candy, but I'm sure he could tell I was lying. He was sweating under his cassock, his glasses fogged up, and his hair curling in thin wisps away from his neck. From the hill, I could see the sun cutting an unhurried line through the water, the ferry returning from the islands, and the shaded back of Barba Ivan's place. People were ranged along the vineyard fence all the way down into the overgrowth behind the house. Nada stood on the downstairs balcony, smoking with about 6 or 7 other women, widows hunched like birds in their black dresses, and a few middle-aged housewives in fish-splashed towels who had just come up from the beach. Nada had set food out on a long rectangular table under the olive tree, and every few minutes she would lower a tray down to the people crowding the fence. Zora stood by an oil drum fire behind the diggers, frowning at something on the bottom of her shoe. Armed with disinfectants, several liters of water, and some knowledge of what was to come, she was there to salvage the community's faith in us by forestalling a medical disaster. She did not want my help. Out among the vines, Duray was bending over something with a damp cloth, wiping it down slowly from end to end, making a visible effort not to move it around too much. It was a suitcase of some kind, an old-fashioned valise, patent leather cracked, handles frayed gray. This, I realized, was why Duray had been confident that the body would eventually make an appearance, why he had been willing to overlook the reality of dogs and floods. He had safeguarded the cousin, whom I had previously imagined to be the occupant of a shallow grave, by stuffing him into a suitcase. Duray was wiping the sides down slowly, with great care, enormous relief at having recovered the case evident in his face. 12 years of accounting for his inability to return the body, his negligence in leaving a family member behind, loyalty suspect, always defending himself from the conclusions they must have been drawing when he explained himself. Had he abandoned a dying man, killed him, and disposed of the body? And the illness itself, how his thoughts must have turned straight to the body when his wife and children began falling ill one by one. How he must have circled around his own guilt, hinted at it, while he searched for cures from the village crone, until the old woman finally caught on and told him what he wanted to hear, pointed to his recklessness and irresponsibility with the body, absolved him by confirming that the burden was his. The evening began with a blessing. This had been scrawled on a piece of neon green paper in handwriting that was presumably illegible. Duray read it aloud, slowly, stumbling over the words, over the name of the Father and of the Son, and over some invocation that mystified him so thoroughly he was forced to summon help from some of the other diggers. While they tried in vain to decipher their guidelines, I imagined the old woman who had sent them there, alone in a small, cold house high above Duray's village, as milky-eyed and supple-limbed as a toad, devoting every ounce of strength to composing this blessing she knew by heart, but had never written down. Her notes urged the diggers to wail, but their hesitation made their efforts seem half-hearted. Shawled and bent, the old woman would have given the process dignity, produced a sound long and hollow and endless, a sound that would have dispersed the audience along the vineyard fence. Instead, the discordant howl of the diggers roused the onlookers into a steady chorus of, "Wash the bones, bring the body, leave the heart behind," that started first among the most inebriated of the men, but pretty soon spread up and down the line. Fra Anton had incense, and he was swinging it back and forth helplessly over the valise while Duray read on, and the diggers coughed and crossed themselves. There was still no sign of the little girl. The heat of the day, compounded by my early morning in the vineyard, had caught up to me. I felt I'd waited years for the body to be found, though I'd only heard about it that morning. Somehow being in Zrevkov had changed everything, and I didn't know what I was waiting for anymore. My backpack was on my knees, my grandfather's belongings folded up inside. I wondered what they would look like without him. His watch, his wallet, his hat, reduced by his absence to objects you could find at a flea market in somebody's attic. The opening of the valise was preceded by a baptism with holy water from one of the diggers' herbed bottles. Fra Anton sprinkled it himself, and then Duray tried the zipper. Not surprisingly, after more than a decade underground, the zipper did not budge. In the end, they agreed to cut the suitcase open, and someone ran for a kitchen knife from the house, which Nada handed over from the balcony. The diggers were deliberating over where to make the incision. Total silence from the spectators for Duray's backswing, and then the knife went in. A strained creak, followed almost immediately by the stench of decay. The body groaned. That sound, straining like a violin, stretched between fire and fence. Someone behind me called for God. Arms swung into action. Up and down the fence, people were crossing themselves. Zora, meanwhile, had been standing by all this time, watching the proceedings, her whole body tensed up like piano wire. I would later find out that before things got underway, she had asked Duray if he really expected to find a heart in the valise, and he'd said, "What do you think I am, some sort of idiot?" To which Zora, by no small miracle, did not reply. But now that groans from the valise had shaken the entire town into paroxysmal supplication, she couldn't restrain herself any longer. "That's just the gases depressurizing," she said, loudly and to no one in particular. But the diggers were undeterred. More chanting and wailing, Fra Anton refusing to touch the herbed bottle, renouncing their holy water, but still swinging that incense patiently over the suitcase, the pot catching the light of the falling sun. Zora waited for another opportunity to offer her opinion, but minutes went by, and none came. She drew back to my side of the vineyard, came up the slope, dusting her hands against her coat, and stood over me. I pushed myself across the rock ledge to make room for her. "I have a message for you," she said. She handed me her coat and then took off her sweater. She laid the sweater out on the ground beside me and sat down on it, took her coat back across her knees. "Your grandma says you opened the bag. You'd better not bother coming home." Zora said this without looking at me. Her throat was beaded with sweat from standing too close to the fire. She was emphatic on that point. Everything I had expected her to say, she let fall between us. and I couldn't remember the answers I had been preparing. Duray had moistened a clean rag with water from the herbed bottle and was taking the cousin out of the suitcase, bone by bone, rubbing the long yellowed blades of the legs gently with the cloth, laying them down on a clean sheet on the ground. The other diggers hovered over him, smoking, their backs to the fence. They had closed off the ritual, speaking quietly with smaller gestures, either following the directions of their village crone, or, owing to the animated reaction of the onlookers, who, having guessed that the liveliest portion of the proceedings had come and gone, were beginning to lose interest anyway. "What would you do?" I said. "That depends," said Zora. "What would your grandfather say?" "He'd tell me to humor my grandma, not to open the bag." "We'll never get back by Saturday," Zora told me. "But you know that." She took my hand and held it on her knee and didn't say anything. The wet rag was passing from hand to hand, and they were squeezing the water out of it onto the bones, the cracked dome of the skull, wiping down the empty sockets and the crooked lines between the teeth. The spinal column was materializing on the sheet, the vertebral discs like toys. So many hands in the suitcase, it was hard to tell who was removing what, but someone was meticulous and organized, sorting the pieces out on the sheet, joints here, fingers there, even though the whole thing would be folded up into itself later. Then they were breaking the thigh bones, sawing through them with a cleaver, so the body would not walk in death, to bring sickness to the living. And Duray was rolling up the rag, winding it tight over his fist, and calling it the heart. And I felt stupid for not considering this possibility, the metaphorical heart, and for doubting the old crone, wherever she was. Silence while Duray moistened the rag again, three splashes of water for the newly baptized heart, the clenched wad of it tight and heavy in his fist. The heavyset man brought out a small brass pot, and Duray lowered the rag into it carefully, poured oil on it, and set it on fire. And for a long time the little brass pot stood on the ground with the family leaning forward to look at it. They were adding water to the brass pot, which was smoking now, putting it over the oil drum coals, and Duray baptized the fire and the bones with what was left of the water, and then tossed the bottle aside. All along the fence, the onlookers were beginning to dissipate, buckling under the weight of their expectations. A couple of boys were kicking a soccer ball along the vineyard fence. Then the water was boiling, and Duray took the pot off the fire, and the men began passing it around quietly, without emotion, steadfast drinkers all, trying not to spill the ash water. Some of the men removed their hats as they did this. Some didn't bother to put out their cigarettes. Fra Antun carried his incense over to us and stood there, watching the slow progression of the brass pot and the faces of the men who had already had their share of the heart. "Where's the little girl?" I asked him. "Inside," said Fra Antun, sleeping. They had her out here with a fever this afternoon. My mother threatened to call the police if they tried to bring her back out again. It was getting dark now. The sun had dipped below the side of the peninsula, and the sky in the west was draining quickly into the water. While we watched, one of the boys from the burial party put on his hat and went by us quickly. Zora was already holding out an offering of water and disinfectant, but he pushed past her and went through the gate at the end of the vineyard. And with him, it was over. The tight secrecy of the circle around the valise had unraveled. One of the men wiped his mouth and laughed about something. "What now?" Zora said.
"Now comes the vigil," Fra Antun told her.
"Where's that kid going?" she said.
"To get someone from outside the family to bury the ashes on the hill."
"Why doesn't he do it himself?"
"Family member," Fra Antun said. "He can't." "What about you?" "Well, I won't." Peering down at us from the underside of his glasses, he looked like an enormous dragonfly. "He'll have a hard time getting anyone to go up to the crossroads after a body's come up."
"The crossroads?"
"For our Mora," said Fra Antun with a smile. "The spirit who comes to gather the dead."
I was saying, "I'll do it," before my mind had fully come around what he might mean.
"Don't be stupid," Zora said, looking at me.
Fra Antun was biting his nails, letting the two of us sort it out ourselves.
I said, "Tell Duray and the family I'll go to the crossroads on their behalf if they send the mother and the kids down to the clinic in the morning."
And now we jump back in time to the story of the tiger in Natalia's grandfather's childhood home.
While the villagers of Galina are reluctant to talk about the tiger and his wife, they will never hesitate to tell you stories of one of the lateral participants in their story. Ask someone from Galina about Darisha the bear, and the conversation will begin with a story that isn't true. Darisha was raised by bears, or he ate only bears. In some versions, he had spent 20 years hunting a great black bruin that had eluded other hunters from time out of mind, even Vuk Sibich, who had killed the fabled wolf of Kolovats. In the end, the advocates of that narrative say the bear grew so weary of Darisha's pursuit that it came to his camp in the night and lay down to die, and Darisha talked to it while it was dying, like this in the snow, until its spirit passed into him at first light. My personal favorite, however, was the story that Darisha's tremendous success as a hunter was derived from his ability to actually turn into a bear, that he did not kill, as men killed, with gun or poison or knife, but with tooth and claw. With savage tearing of flesh, great ursine teeth locked into the throat of his opponent, making a sound as loud as the breaking of a mountain. All these variations come down to one truth, however. Darisha was the greatest bear hunter in the Old Kingdom. That, at least, is fact. There is evidence of it. There are pictures of Darisha before the incident with the tiger's wife, pictures in which Darisha, light-eyed and stone-faced, stands over the piled hides of bears, almost invariably in the company of some spindly-legged member of the aristocracy, whose cheerful grin is intended to conceal knees still shaking from the hunt. In these pictures, Darisha is guileless and unsmiling, as charismatic as a lump of coal, and it's hard to understand how he managed to generate such a loyal following among the villagers of Galina. The bears in these pictures tell a different story, too, one of death in excess. But then, no one ever looks to them for answers. Darisha came to Galina once a year, right after the Christmas feasts, to indulge in village hospitality and to sell furs in anticipation of the hardening winter. His entrance was expected but sudden. People never saw him arrive, only awoke to the pleasant realization that he was already there, his horse tethered, oxen unhitched from their cart, fare spread out on a faded blue carpet. Darisha was short and bearded, and in passing might have been taken for a beggar. But like his quiet manner and his tendency to indulge the morbid curiosity of children, he seemed to bring with him a wilder, more admirable world. He brought news and warmth, too, and occasionally stories of the wilderness and the animals that peopled it. And the villagers of Galina associated his arrival with good luck and seasonal stability. Until that particular winter, my grandfather had looked forward to the yearly visit of Darisha the bear with as much enthusiasm as anyone else in the village. But distracted by the tiger and his wife, my grandfather had forgotten all about him. The other villagers, however, had not. Instead, the inevitability of his appearance had loomed on and on in their collective consciousness, something that they avoided mentioning, lest their reliance on its surety prevent his arrival. So when they emerged from their houses one late January morning and saw him there, brown and dirty and as welcome as a promise, Their hearts rose. My grandfather, who would otherwise have been first in line to walk up and down the faded blue carpet and stare at the open-jawed heads of bears, eyes glass or stone, or altogether missing, looked through the window and realized, with dread, what was going to happen. Across the square, the tiger's wife was probably looking out at Darisha too, but she did not know the gravity of the commotion that was animating the village. She did not guess, as my grandfather must have guessed, that the priest rushing toward Darisha with open arms was not just saying hello, but also, "Praise God you've come safely through. You must rid us of this devil in his fiery pajamas." All along, my grandfather had hoped for a miracle, but expected disaster. He was 9, but he had known, since the encounter in the smokehouse, that he and the tiger's wife were caught on one side of a failing fight. He did not understand the opponents. He did not want to. Mother Vera's unexpected assistance had been a sign of hope, but he didn't know what the hope was toward. And with the hunters coming, my grandfather realized immediately that the odds were now heavily weighted against the tiger. Darisha the bear, who for so long had represented something admirable and untouchable, became a betrayer, a murderer, a killer of tigers, a knife-wielding, snare-setting instrument of death that would be directed at something sacred. And my grandfather had no doubt that, given enough time, Darisha would succeed. You've just heard The Tiger's Wife, a 2011 novel by Taya Obrit. Hope you can join us next time for more on Chapter a Day. I'm Susan Sweeney. Thank you.